Would you like to come with me to Job chapter 39? Now, John Cassam was supposed to be standing here this evening. I am not John Cassam, and he is not me. Unfortunately, John's had a high temperature and has been taken unwell, so John is not here this evening. And therefore, we're taking a little bit of a break from our series because I wasn't expecting to be doing this evening. So we're just going to look at something which I hope will be of help and encouragement and refreshment to us, but it sits outside our series on how, so it just stands on its own. So please have Job 39 open in front of you. We're not going to read it now. We're going to read it as we go through the exposition. But we're going to call the study tonight The Moral Maze. The Moral Maze. Now, as we come to this chapter, chapter 39, and in fact, it's just a couple of verses at the end of chapter 38, and a few verses at the beginning of chapter 40, but as we come to this passage, Job wants his day in court. In fact, throughout the book of Job, Job wants his day in court. He wants God to come and explain to Job the morality of Job's suffering. He wants God to come and explain why he's done what he's done to Job. Now, if you remember, Job loses everything in a day. His property, his servants, his wealth, his standing. Agonizingly, he loses his children. And a little later on, he loses his health as well. He loses everything. And remember, this is innocent suffering. Job's three friends, their comforters, they come along and say, "Oh, Job, we have the explanation for what you've done. It's because you're a sinner and God is dealing with you as you deserve because of your sin." But that's not true at all, is it? Job is not suffering because he's unrighteous. It's the absolute opposite of that. He's suffering because he is righteous. Satan says, "Does Job fear God for nothing? It's only God because you're so good to Job that he fears you. If you take away all his benefits, all his blessings, he'll curse you to his face." And so God takes away everything. And Job doesn't curse God. He suffers because he is a righteous man. And Job knows it. He effectively says to his three friends, "Yes, of course I'm a sinner, but not in a way that explains what has happened to me." And so Job wants his day in court. And he uses a lot of legal language throughout. You know, "Why am I suffering," he says, "when effectively I've done nothing wrong? And it's for God to come and to justify his dealings with me and to provide me with an answer." Well, when eventually towards the end of the book God himself appears and Job says, "I want an answer," God says, "No. It's for you actually, Job, to answer me." And so God gives Job question after question. For Job, they're difficult questions. Questions involving hard decisions about suffering, about the morality of suffering, about the purpose of suffering. God effectively says to Job, "Before you start pointing the finger at me, how would you deal with these issues, Job? You've got a lot to say about suffering. Well, Job, how competent are you to judge what is right and what is wrong?" So Job's moral maze. So we're just going to go through some of the questions which God asks him. And he asks him a number of questions from the animal kingdom. So if you like animals, a good passage to have a look at. It's a good one to do with children. Job's moral maze. So first of all, start off a question about the eater and the eaten. So look at verse 39. "Can you hunt the prey for the lion, or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lurk in their lairs to lie in wait? Who provides food for the raven when its young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food?" So God is effectively giving there Job a moral maze. He's saying to Job, whose side are you on? Are you on the side of the lioness who must feed her cubs? Or are you on the side of her prey? Come on, Job, you decide which should live and which should die. And what about the raven? The raven feeds on carrion. It feeds on dead animals. It feeds on dead animals to feed her helpless nestlings. Well, therefore, an animal must die so that her nestlings can live. So come on, Job, which is better? Is it better that animal should live and there's then no food for her nestlings? Which should live and which should die? It's a question, Job, about suffering. Should the antelope live? And the young lions starve? Should the nestlings feed, even though it means the death of another? Come on, Job, you decide. After all, God makes these decisions all the time. Luke chapter 20, turn to it. Luke chapter 12. Consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, which have neither storehouse nor barn, and God feeds them. So God's making these decisions all of the time, these moral decisions. And then a question about parenting. So I'd like to read Job 39 in the first four verses. And think about, as we go through this, think about what the moral maze is. What's the dilemma that Job is having to work out? So someone read, please, Job 39, 1 to 4. Thank you. So, what's the moral dilemma? A lot of stress on what the goats go through to bear young. What's the dilemma? Every mother will feel this at some time in her life.
The young depart.
The young depart, don't they? Okay, here's this mountain goat. The mother carries the young over many months. There's a lot of goes on about the pain, the difficulty of going through labour. They bow down, they bring forth the young, they deliver their offspring. And then after going through all of that, her young leave her. They depart and do not return to them. She goes through all that, and then they walk away, and she never sees them again. So, Job, there's a dilemma there, isn't there? Is it better they stay with their mother for a long, long time? Or is it better that they leave her? They should be allowed to go. It's a question about suffering of some degree, isn't it? Look at the next one. This is a question of usefulness. Someone like to read, please, verses 5 to 12. It's a big chunk, but it's beautiful language. Someone would like to read 5 to 12.
Who set the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the onager? Whose home I have made the wilderness and the barren land his dwelling? He scorns the tumult of the city. He does not heed the shouts of the driver. The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with rugs? Or will he plough the valleys behind you? Will he trust him because his strength is great? Or will you leave your labour to him? Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it?
Okay, so two animals are spoken of there. One's a wild donkey, particular species, an onager, and the other is a wild ox. They're both two wild species. And what's the moral maze? What's the moral question that's being put to Job there? It's the same question for both animals. Yeah, that's right. You have these two very powerful animals, don't you? There's the wild donkey and there's the wild ox. They're both very powerful, both very strong, a lot of stamina in them, a lot of strength in them, but they can't be yoked. They run wild. You can't subdue them. You can't domesticate them. So there's a moral question there, isn't there? Should God take away its freedom? And then it would be useful, wouldn't it? You could yoke it, you could chain it, it could do work for you. But it means taking away its freedom. Well, sure, you give it its freedom and let it roam around as it does in the wild places, but it's never useful. You can't do anything with it. Which is the right thing to do? What would you do? Job, what would you do? He's saying, come on, Job, you decide. You organise its lifestyle. Here's a moral question that involves a degree of suffering. So what's the right answer, Job? What should be done? After all, Job, you've got an awful lot to say about how I run the universe. You want me, Job, to come and stand in the dock and explain how I run the universe? Well, Job, how would you run this, just this little tiny bit of the universe? The wild donkey and the wild ox. You see the way God is making Job think. Making us think as well, isn't he? Okay. Another question then. Where are we now? Going on to verses 13 to 18. Now, here's a question. It might be a question of safety. It might be a question of stupidity. It might be a question of strength. So someone like to read, please, verses 13 to 18. And think about as we're going through, what's the moral maze? What's the moral question? 13 to 18. Okay, so there you've got an ostrich. What's the issue about the ostrich? What's God asking Job to sort out? Well, not to sort out, but to work out. It's stupid. It's a stupid bird, all right? So God has made a stupid bird. Okay. In what way does it display its stupidity? The forgetfulness, yeah. What is it? What particularly? What does it forget? Yeah, it's an incompetent parent, all right? It lays eggs on the ground where the eggs can be trodden on, all right? So it flaps its wings around, looks very important, lays its eggs on the ground, forgets that a foot may crush them or that a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly as though they weren't hers. Okay? All right, so she's a bad parent, she's foolish. What advantage, though, does she have? What's the compensating aspect that an ostrich has? It tells it right at the end. What can she do that gives her an advantage?
Her strength.
Her strength, yeah, and particularly in terms of... She's very quick, isn't she? So it says here, when she lifts herself on high, she scorns the horse and its rider. So she can... It's difficult to hunt her, all right? Because she's very quick, she's very fast, she can see a long way. Before the horse and rider come, she's off and disappeared into the wilderness. Okay, so it's all moral questions, isn't it? God has made a bird that's very strong, but is also very stupid. She can outrun the horse and its rider, but then she can't keep her eggs safe. All right, so should God give her more wisdom so that she cares for her eggs, stays with her eggs? But then if she stays with her eggs, she's going to be more vulnerable to the hunter, isn't she? If she stays protecting her eggs, she's more likely to be caught. So is it better that she gets away and doesn't think about her eggs, or stays with her eggs and gets caught? And maybe God should give her bigger wings, because she goes around these small wings, doesn't she? If he gives her bigger wings, she can be like the stork, she can fly up into the tree, she can build a nest in the tree, her eggs would be safe. But then if he gave her bigger wings so she could best fly like the stork, then she wouldn't be an ostrich. And none of us would ever seen an ostrich, because an ostrich wouldn't exist. All right? What should God do? What's the right thing to do? Come on, Job, you know the answer. All right, question now about power. Someone please read verses 19 to 25. Don't be bashful.
Have you given the horse strength? Have you clothed his neck with armor? Can you frighten him like the locust? His majestic snorting strikes terror. He
falls in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He mocks at fear as not rising, nor does he turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, the glittering spear and javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and rage, nor does he come to a halt because the trumpet has sounded. At a blast of the trumpet, he says, aha, he smells the battle from afar, the thundering of captains and shouting.
Thank you. He's talking about a war horse, isn't it? Here's a war horse. Okay, what's the moral maze? What's the dilemma you're faced with a war horse?
He's fearless.
Right, he's fearless, yeah. So what? That's gone. Okay, so there's a recklessness about him. There's an aggressiveness. Can lead to his death, yeah. Yeah, always. I want you to write things. It's any more sort of things, thoughts?
Disobedient.
He's okay. When's he like? Okay, when's he going to be a problem? When's a war horse a problem? Doesn't okay. When there's no war, yes. So a war horse is great in war, isn't it? Because that's what you want. You want a great big aggressive, fearless. People have this old expression of it, like he's like an old war horse, because as soon as the bugle sounds, the ears go up and the horse is ready to charge and isn't frightened of anything and snorts and thunders down the valley and whatever. Well, that's great, isn't it, if you've got a war? But of course, most of the time you're not at war, are you? So a war horse most of the time is a real pain, because you've got this great big aggressive fearless beast, and all you're doing is trotting it around the paddock and trying to keep it in a stable. I'm trying to get it to behave. It's not going to be child-friendly. It's not going to be very approachable. Now, you know, he's got this big, aggressive beast, fearless, powerful, difficult to control. If God toned it down so it was a gentler beast and the children could sit on its back and everyone would be thinking, this is what a lovely horse you've got, and you could feed it sugar lumps and all the rest of it, it'd be no good as a war horse, would it? It might be wonderful in peacetime, but then the one time you need it, it's going to be useless. So again, it's a moral question, isn't it? What should God do? Come on, Job. And then the last question which he sets before Job, in this part of it, it goes on to ask him other questions, but in this part we're looking at tonight. Someone read please verses 26 to 30. Again, think about the moral question that's being asked. Okay. So what's the moral question? How many people have seen an eagle here? I mean, an eagle flying, an eagle soaring. How many people have seen an eagle soaring? Yeah. Okay, what impression does an eagle soaring have upon you? What's the impact?
Freedom.
Okay, so it's a freedom, the power. But actually, what impact does it have on you as you sort of stood there and watched it? What did you feel? Okay, Jeff drives into a boulder. It's an amazing sight, isn't it? It's one of those moments you think, oh, look at that. Yes, I mean you're filled with awe and wonder, aren't you? Okay, so you're watching this eagle. We're filled with awe and wonder. What's the eagle doing up there? It's hunting, isn't it? Okay, there's a moral dilemma, isn't there? It's soaring in the air, it's master of all it surveys, it lives in an impregnable stronghold in the rock on the mountain. But what's it doing there? It's looking for food. It says verse 30, its young ones suck up the blood, and there, and where the slain are, there it is. Okay? So here's a question for you, Job. Job, do you want to see eagles soaring? Knowing that to watch an eagle soar means that no bunny rabbits around here are going to live long and peaceful lives, and they're all going to die young because the eagle's going to swoop down and take them. Okay, so moral question is it better that the bunny rabbits live, I mean, whatever the animals are, the little furry animals live long and happy lives and die in peace? Is it better that happens and there are no eagles? Or is it better that there are eagles, even though it means blood and suffering and death? It's a question about suffering, isn't it? And says God to Job, you decide. Verse 4, chapter 40, verse 1. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Are you going to tell me I've got all this wrong, Job? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. You've been telling me, Job, I've got all this wrong. You've been telling me, Job, I don't know what I'm doing in the matters of suffering and morality. Well, come on, Job, you answer these questions. You find fault in my dealings with you. You believe I've got a case to answer. You want me to stand and answer you in the dock, answer questions about justice and rightness and wrongness. Well, before I do that, Job, you answer these questions. I'm not going to ask you about the moral government of the universe. And these aren't big questions, Job. These are little questions. These are starters for 10. These are just a few animals here and there which you've seen and which you know about. So how would you answer them, Job? Who should live? The lions or their prey? And what about the ravens? Should the ravens live off dead creatures because that involves death and suffering? Or should the ravens and their young perish? You decide, Job. Come on, you tell me. And what about the young mountain goats that abandon their mother after all that the mother has done for them? And the wild donkey, the wild ox, should they be free and useless? Or should they be chained and useful? And Job, what are you going to do about the ostrich? There's a bird, eh? Are you going to make her wings bigger? Are you going to slow her down? Are you going to make her wiser and therefore more vulnerable, but better able to care for her offspring? And what about war horses? All that power mixed with the arrogance and fierceness, so hard to handle in peacetime, but when the war comes, how thankful you are you've got them. And the eagle. Would it be better off if we never saw an eagle? If we never saw an eagle, there'd be less blood, less suffering. What do you think, Job? Is God wrong to make these creatures? To endow them with the qualities that they have? Qualities that necessitate suffering? Remember, God has made these creatures. He's made them, and the qualities that they have mean that there will be suffering, mean that there will be death. So, Job, can you navigate the moral maze? Can you run the universe better than me? After all, that's what you seem to be saying in my dealings with you, Job. Job, this is a world of suffering, where suffering serves a wider purpose, where of necessity, if one must live, then another must die. Now, we're not at the end of what Job says with all these questions, but just look at what he says in verses 3 to 5, chapter 40. Then Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. I put my hand over my mouth. I'm not going to say anything more. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further. I just don't know what I've been talking about. I've been saying, God, you come and answer me, but actually I can't even answer these simple moral questions about suffering. So how on earth I'm supposed to... And he's beginning to see the bigger question, isn't he? He's beginning to see the universe as an end at Job's door. If he can't explain these things, these simple things, why should he expect to understand God's purpose in his own suffering? He's jumped to a conclusion, he's demanded a response, but says Job, I didn't know what I was talking about. And he's beginning to see, isn't he, that there is another wisdom. It's not the wisdom that seeks an explanation and then says, oh, I see, now I see what you were doing. It's a wisdom spoken of a little bit earlier in Job. I won't need to turn to it, I'll just read it. It's this wisdom. Behold, the fear of the Lord, That is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. Well, let's just apply these things to ourselves. Now, brothers and sisters, we have lots of questions in life, don't we? One of the questions we have is, why has God made me like I am? Yes? I mean, we might put that down to, you know, we might sort of say, why have I got this colour hair, those colour eyes, this shape of figure? Why have I been made to look like this? That's part of it. But actually, it usually runs a bit deeper, doesn't it? Why has God endowed me with the qualities that I have? Yeah, because some people are like the ostrich, aren't they? Some people are strong, but they're stupid. Why has God made them like that? Some people are like a warhorse. 90% of the time, they are impossible to live with. Aren't they? There are people like that. They're aggressive, they're fierce, they thunder down the valley, you can't control them. But then, 1 in 10 times, you suddenly think, oh, that's why they've been put upon the earth. Because you put them in the right context, and suddenly it all makes sense. You needed that person in that particular setting because they would sort it out. But the rest of the time, they just go around causing trouble. Why has God, you know, there are war horses, aren't there? Think of Churchill. When there's a war on, he comes into his own, doesn't he? But he's not a great peacetime leader. There are some people who are like the wild ox. Yeah, they're so useful. Well, they would be so useful, but you see, they have a free spirit, and therefore you can't rely upon them. There are some people who've got so many qualities, so many strengths, so much stamina, they could do so much for the kingdom of God, but you can't rely upon them. They've got a free spirit, they wander off, they won't take any yoke on them. And you feel they're lost, really. And there are some people like the young of mountain goats, aren't they? You give yourself to them. You really give your heart, you give your life, you give everything to them. And then they clear off and don't return. And just look at the church. You find all those types in the church, don't you? And we're not saying who's who. I mean, there are probably ostriches in the church. There are war horses in the church. There are wild ox in the church. Are there mountain goats in the church? And probably some other creatures as well. And I'm sure there are times when you get very frustrated with people. I get very frustrated with people. I'm sure there are times when you get very frustrated with me. Because we have these mixture of qualities, don't we? That sometimes are a dilemma. Some people within the same body, within the same person, you have wonderful qualities and destructive qualities. If that person stays close to the Lord, they will do wonderful things in the life of the church. If that person doesn't stay close to the Lord, they will destroy the church. There are people who have the power within them to bring great blessing or great destruction within a church. And some of us have completely contradictory things going on inside us, don't we? And we think, well, why has God made me like this? It's a dilemma, isn't it? Why has God made Amy and Park Chapel like it is? With all the contradictory things in Amy and Park Chapel. Another question, why has God ordered my life as he has? In all our lives, there's suffering. In all our lives, there is distress. There are times in my life and your life when my gain will be at the expense of another. I will gain. I will be blessed. Advantage will come to me, but it'll mean for another sorrow, grief, trouble, trial. As long as it's the other way, isn't it? The sorrow, grief, trouble, trial comes to me and they get the blessing. And we have experiences which I can never forget. And there are experiences which I want to forget. There is the soaring eagle, and there is the shedding of blood. Another question, why has God so ordered his world? We all find ourselves in Job's moral maze, don't we? There are equations in God's world that we can't balance. There are times we just can't make any sense of the pattern. And we could all talk about our own particular situations, can't we? But, you know, there's the Garden of Eden. How wonderful, there's paradise. But then why is the serpent in the Garden of Eden? What's Satan doing there? And what of my sin, the grief that I've been born into this world, a wicked sinner, going my own way? But then if I'd never been a sinner, I would never have known the grace of God in all its dimensions. So maybe me being a sinner is the best of all worlds, because if I hadn't been a sinner, I'd never known the God who loves and embraces sinners. It's a moral question, isn't it? And what about election? God choosing a people for himself, his own special people, who he will save. They are the elect. And yet there's human responsibility. Those who go to hell deserve to go to hell and choose to go to hell and are fully responsible for going to hell. And a never-ending hell. And an eternal heaven. And what of the cross? There's a moral question, isn't there? The Son of God, the only true innocent in all the universe, and he suffers as no other has ever suffered. He suffers for the sin of the world. It's the suffering of the just for the unjust. And we begin to see what God has done through innocent suffering. And we begin to see the wisdom of God, don't we? Who can navigate the moral maze? This is God's universe. It's a moral universe. At the judgment, all will be revealed. And the judge himself will be vindicated. There is a wonderfully wise explanation for who I am, for the way that my life is, for the part that I play in this world, for the way that the world is. There is a wonderfully wise explanation for it all, but you need the mind of God to understand it. Only God can explain God. Only God can explain the way that he does what he does. And you need the mind of God to understand the intricacies and the beauty and the wonders of the design. And we know ultimately that all of God's design, and this is the true wonder of it, all of God's design ultimately is Christ-shaped. That's why Paul, when he gets to the end of a passage talking about the wonders of God's design, he says this: oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments, and his ways past finding out. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has become his counselor, or who has first given to him that it should be repaid to him? For of him, and through him, and to him are all things, to whom be glory for ever and ever. So that being so, when we face our moral dilemmas, our moral mazes, our questions as to my life, the wider life, the way which the world is, what is my wisdom? It's what we read a little bit earlier. I need to turn to it, but Job 28:28. This is what God says. And to man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. Wisdom is not found in getting answers. Wisdom is found in the fear of the Lord. The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. Only God knows how he governs his universe. My business is to govern my life by his word. Only God can interpret the mysteries of providence. My business is to know what I should be doing today to please the Lord Jesus Christ. Never mind the big picture, never mind the big questions, never mind, as it were, peering through the keyhole into my father's study and wonder what he's up to. My business is to trust and obey, to love and worship the Lord. Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding.